So I'm going to start with a reading from the Heart Sutra and then later on the some portions of the Diamond Sutra. Heart Sutra. Homage to the perfection of wisdom, the lovely, the holy. Avalokita, the holy Lord and Bodhisattva was moving in the deep course of the wisdom which has gone beyond. He looked down from on high, he beheld but five hips, and he saw that in their own being they were empty. Here, Sariputra, from form is emptiness, and the very emptiness is form. Emptiness does not differ from form. Form does not differ from emptiness. Whatever is form, that is emptiness. Whatever is emptiness, that is form. The same is true of feelings, perceptions, impulses, and consciousness. Here, Sariputra, all dharmas are marked with emptiness. They are not produced or stopped, nor defiled or immaculate, not deficient or complete. Therefore, Sariputra, in emptiness there is no form or feeling, nor perception, nor impulse, nor consciousness. No eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. No forms, sounds, smells, tastes, touchables, or objects of mind. No sight, organ, element, and no food. Until we come to no mind consciousness element, there is no ignorance, no extinction of ignorance, and so forth. Until we come to, there is no decay and death, no extinction of decay and death, there is no suffering, no origination, no stopping, no path, there is no cognition, no attainment, and non-attainment. Therefore, Sariputta, it is because of his non-attainmentness that a bodhisattva, through having relied on the perfection of wisdom, dwells without thought coverings. In the absence of thought coverings, he has not been able to tremble. He has overcome what can upset and what, and in the end, he attains to nirvana. All those who appear as Buddhas in the three periods of time, fully awakened to the utmost, right and perfect enlightenment, because they have relied on the perfection of perfection of wisdom should be. Therefore, one should know the Prajna Paramita as the great spell, the spell of great knowledge, the utmost spell, the unequaled spell, all layer of all suffering, in truth, for what we could go wrong. By the Prajna Paramita has this spell been delivered. It runs like this. Tadyatha om gate gate parasam gate bodhi swaha. That is gone, gone, gone beyond, gone altogether beyond. Oh, what an awakening, all hell. Now I think you have got the whole Diamond Sutra, but I'm going to read some sections. I will tell which section I'm going to read. The first, see the section number 3. The real teaching of the great way. Buddha said, Subhuti, all the bodhisattvas, hero, should discipline their thoughts as follows. All living creatures or whatever class, born from eggs, from wombs, from moisture, or by transformation, whether with form or without form, whether in a state of thinking or exempt from thought necessity, or wholly beyond all thought realms, all these are caused by me to attain unbound bounded liberation, nirvana. Yet when vast, uncountable, immeasurable numbers of beings have thus been liberated, verily no being has been liberated. Why is this, Subhuti? It is because no bodhisattva, who is a real bodhisattva, cherishes the idea of an ego entity, a personality, a being, or a separated individuality. Section 4. Even the most beneficent practices are relative. Furthermore, Subhuti, in the practice of charity, a bodhisattva should be detached. That is to say, he should practice charity without regard to appearances, without regard to sound, odor, touch, flavor, or any quality. Subhuti, thus should the bodhisattva practice charity without attachment. Wherefore, in such a case, his merit is incalculable. Subhuti, what do you think? Can you measure all the space extending eastward? No, Lord, no world-honored one, I cannot. Then can you, Subhuti, measure all the space extending southward, westward, northward, or in any other direction, including nadir and zenith? No, world-honored one, I cannot. Well, Subhuti, equally incalculable is the merit of a bodhisattva who practices charity without any attachment to appearances. Subhuti, bodhisattvas should preserve no one pointedly in this instruction. Section 7. Great ones, perfect beyond learning, utter no words of teaching. Subhuti, what do you think? Has the Tathagata attained the consummation of incomparable enlightenment? Has the Tathagata a teaching to enunciate? Subhuti answered, as I understand Buddha's meaning, there is no formulation of truth called consummation of incomparable enlightenment. Moreover, the Tathagata has no formulated teaching to enunciate. Wherefore, because the Tathagata has said that truth is uncontainable and inexpressible, it neither is nor is it not. Thus, it is that this unformulated principle is the foundation of the different systems of all the sages. Section 8, the fruits of meritorious action. Subhuti, what do you think? If anyone filled 3,000 galaxies of worlds with the 7 treasures and gave all away in gifts of alms, would he gain great merit? Subhuti said, great indeed, world honor one. Wherefore? Because merit partakes of the character of no merit. The Tathagata characterized the merit as great. Then Buddha said, on the other hand, if anyone received and retained even only 4 lines of this discourse and taught and explained them to others, his merit would be the greater. Wherefore? Because Subhuti, from this discourse issue forth all the Buddhas, and consummation of incomparable enlightenment teachings of all the Buddhas. Subhuti, what is called the religion given by Buddha is not in fact Buddha religion. Section 9. Real designation is undesignate. Subhuti, what do you think? Does a disciple who has entered the stream of the holy life say within himself, I obtain the fruit of a stream entrant? Subhuti said, no, world honored one. Wherefore? Because stream entrant is merely a name. There is no stream entering. The disciple who pays no regard to form, sound, odor, taste, touch, or any quality is called a stream entrant. Subhuti, what do you think? Does an adept who is subject to only one more rebirth say within himself, I obtain the fruit of a once to be reborn? Subhuti said, no, world honor one. Wherefore? Because one once to be reborn is merely a name. There is no passing away nor coming into existence. The adept who realizes this is called once to be reborn. Subhuti, what do you think? does a venerable one who will never more be reborn as a mortal say within himself, I obtain the fruit of a non-returner? Subhuti said, no, world honor one. Wherefore? Because no returner is merely a name. There is no non-returning. Hence the designation non-returner. Subhuti, what do you think? Does a holy one say within himself, I have obtained perfect enlightenment? Subhuti said, no, world honor one. Wherefore? Because there is no such condition as that called perfect enlightenment. World honored one, if a holy one of perfective enlightenment said to himself, such am I, he would necessarily partake of the idea of an ego entity, a personality, a being, or a separated individuality. World honored one, when the Buddha declares that I excel amongst holy men in the yoga of perfect quiescence, in dwelling in seclusion and in freedom from passions, I do not say within myself, I am a holy one, perfective enlightenment, free from passions. World honor one, if I say it within myself, such am I, you would not declare. Subhuti finds happiness abiding in peace, in seclusion, in the midst of the forest. This is because Subhuti abides nowhere. Therefore, he is called Subhuti, joyful, abider in peace, dweller in seclusion in the forest. Now, the 18, section 18, page 7. All modes of mind are really only mind. Subhuti, what do you think? Does the Tathagata possess the human eye? Yes, world honor one, he does. Well, do you think the Tathagata possesses the divine eye? Yes, world honor one, he does. And do you think the Tathagata possesses the Gnostic eye? Yes, world honor one, he does. And do you think the Tathagata possesses the eye of transcendent wisdom? Yes, world honor one, he does. And do you think the Tathagata possesses the Buddha eye of omniscience? Yes, world honor one, he does. Subhuti, what do you think? Concerning the sand grains of the Ganges, has the Buddha taught about them? Yes, world honor one, the Tathagata has taught concerning these grains. Well, Subhuti, if there were as many Ganges river as the sand grains of the Ganges, and there was a Buddha land for each sand grain in all those Ganges river, would those Buddha land be many? Subhuti replied, many indeed, world honor one. Then Buddha said, Subhuti, however many living beings there are in all those Buddha lands, though they have manifold modes of mind, the Tathagata understands them all. Wherefore? Because the Tathagata teaches that all these are not mind. They are merely called mind. Subhuti, it is impossible to retain past mind, impossible to hold on to present mind, and impossible to grasp future mind. Section 22. It cannot be said that anything is attainable. Then Subhuti asked Buddha, world honor one, in the attainment of the consummation of incomparable enlightenment, did Buddha make no accusation whatsoever? Buddha replied, just so, Subhuti, through the consummation of incomparable enlightenment, I acquired not even the least thing. Therefore, it is called consummation of incomparable enlightenment. Section 26. The body of truth has no marks. Subhuti, what do you think? May the Tathagata be perceived by the 32 marks of a great man? Subhuti answered, no, the Tathagata may not be perceived thereby. Then Buddha said, Subhuti, if the Tathagata may be perceived by such marks, any great imperial ruler is the same as the Tathagata. Subhuti then said to Buddha, world honor one, as I understand the meaning of Buddha's words, the Tathagata may not be perceived by the 32 marks. Whereupon the world honored one uttered this verse, "Who sees me by form? Who seeks me in sound? Perverted art his footstep upon the way, for he cannot perceive the Tathagata." Section 29, Perfect Tranquility. Subhuti, if anyone should say that the Tathagata comes or goes or sits or reclines, he fails to understand my teaching. Why? Because Tathagata has neither whence nor whither, therefore he is called Tathagata. Section 30, The Integral Principle. Subhuti, if a good man or a good woman ground an infinite number of galaxies of worlds to dust, would the resulting minute particles be many? Subhuti replied, "Many indeed, world honor one." Wherefore? Because if such were really minute particles, Buddha would not have spoken of them as minute particles. For as to this, Buddha has declared that they are not really such minute particles, is just the name given to them. Also, world honor one, when the Tathagata speaks of galaxies of worlds, these are not worlds, for if reality could be predicted of a world, it would be a self-existent cosmos, and the Tathagata teaches that there is really no such thing. Cosmos is merely a figure of speech. Then Buddha said, "Subhuti, words cannot explain the real nature of a cosmos. Only common people, fettered with desire, make use of this arbitrary method." Section 31, Conventional Truth Should Be Cut Off. Subhuti, if anyone should say Buddha declares any conception of egoity, do you consider he would understand my teaching correctly? No, world honor one, such a man would not have any sound understanding of the Tathagata's teaching, because the world honor one declares that notions of selfhood, personality, entity and separate individuality as really existing are erroneous. These terms are merely figures of speech. Thereupon Buddha said, "Subhuti, those who aspire to the consummation of incomparable enlightenment should recognize and understand all varieties of things in the same way and cut off the arising of views which are mere aspects." Subhuti, as regard aspects, the Tathagata declares that in reality they are not such. They are called aspects. Section 32, The Delusion of Appearances. Subhuti, someone might fill innumerable worlds with the seven treasures and give all away in gifts of alms. But if any good man or any good woman awakens the thought of enlightenment and takes even only four lines from this discourse, reciting, using, receiving, retaining, and spreading them abroad and explaining them for the benefit of others, it will be far more meritorious. Now, in what manner may he explain them to others? By detachment from appearances, abiding in real truth. So I tell you, thus shall ye think of all this fleeting world: a star at dawn, a bubble in the stream, a flash of lightning in a summer cloud, a flickering lamp, a phantom and a dream. When the Buddha finished his discourse, the venerable Subhuti, together with the bhikshus, bhikshunis, lay brothers and sisters, and the whole realm of gods, men and titans, were filled with joy by his teaching, and taking it sincerely to heart, they went their ways. Thank you.
Very well, thank you very much. I just have a very brief comment to make about the translation of the Heart Sutra that we just heard, because it is a little bit different from the version that I am familiar with and the version that I based my lecture on the Heart Sutra on. There are a few elements in my version that are missing in this version. I don't know exactly why that is, except that, of course, there will be various versions of the text available, because, as you may have noticed, this text doesn't mention the location of the teaching, whereas the text that I use does. It says that the Buddha was dwelling at on the Vulture Peak in Rajagriha, together with a large assembly of monks and bodhisattvas. And this text also doesn't mention the fact that the Buddha is seated in meditation, and that it is through his inspiration that Sariputra asks the question of Avalokiteshvara that prompts this reply. This translation also omits the concluding portion of the discourse where the Buddha commends Avalokiteshvara on his exposition of emptiness. So there are some divergences here. We got this version of the Heart Sutra last night from the internet. You might look, if you have an opportunity, at a book called The Miracle of Mindfulness by Venerable Thich Nhat Hanh. There he has a translation of the Heart Sutra. That, in addition to having the translation of the Heart Sutra, is also a wonderful little book. There's a part in the center of the book, in the middle of the book. It is about 20 pages long, and it's called Exercises in Mindfulness. And in my opinion, it is probably one of the most valuable 20 pages written by anyone about the practice of Buddhism. They are very simple and very effective exercises in mindfulness. So this is a book that, if you ever have an opportunity to get a hold of it, by all means take the opportunity to get it, because it's really a little treasure. It's a small book. It's called The Miracle of Mindfulness by Thich Nhat Hanh. Just to conclude, with regard to the Heart Sutra, the version that I use, of course, is the Tibetan version, but it does include these elements which are, for some reason, missing here. I don't know exactly why. Yes, it's possible. I mean, it was said that in fact is the case. This is just the body of the sutra without the introduction and without the conclusion. So we are about to move on to look at the last of our sutra texts, the Lankavatara Sutra. I think before we do that, I can invite questions about the Prajnaparamita literature or the Heart Sutra or the Diamond Sutra. If you have any questions, I really will be pleased to answer them. My wife says I sounded irritated this morning. I don't know. Maybe I didn't get enough sleep. If I did, then I apologize for that. I didn't mean to dismiss any questions too abruptly, so please bear with me. And if you do have any questions about the Prajnaparamita literature, then please do ask them now, and then we'll continue with the Lankavatara Sutra and the another phase in the development of Mahayana Sutra literature.
any question?
That the that objects are not produced. Is that, could you? I'm sorry, could you? Yes.
All the dhammas?
Yes.
They are not produced, no stopped, no efficient or not?
Yes, yes. Well, the point there, you know, the initial point there, of course, is their non-production. It is the refutation of the origination of dharmas, of factors. And that really is the key to all that follows, because if the dharmas are not produced or not originated, then they're also not stopped, they're also not destroyed, and they also don't endure. So the key to the whole discourse is the non-production or non-origination of the dharmas. Once you establish that the dharmas are not originated, then it follows that they can't endure, they can't persist, and they can't be destroyed, they can't cease to exist, and all the various predications, all the various qualifications of the dharmas will be irrelevant, will be non-applicable once we establish that the dharmas are not originated, that the dharmas do not come into existence. Now, this is a very important point. It's a very key point for the perfection of wisdom, for the understanding of the Prajnaparamita. And it's a point that is examined in great detail in the writing of Nagarjuna. I told the class a couple of days ago that the Mahayana Sutra literature does not enter into argument, it does not enter into reasoning. It uses examples, it uses similes, and it uses declarations. Reasoning and argument in support of the views and support of the truths enunciated, taught in the Perfection of Wisdom literature, use of arguments and reasons in support of those ideas, in support of those declarations, such as the declaration that all dharmas are unoriginated or unproduced, that is left to the writers of the Shastra texts, like Acharya Nagarjuna and others. So in the Perfection of Wisdom literature, in the Sutra literature, you won't find arguments to establish the non-origination of the dharmas. What you will find is examples and similes. And the examples and similes that are used are first and foremost the example of a dream or the example of a magical show, examples of illusion. And when we think about illusion, we have to admit that things which are illusory, such as objects seen in a dream, are not really produced. They're not really originated. Their origination, they appear to originate, but they don't really originate. Their origination is not real. So in this sense, since the origination of all dharmas is not real, so their passing away is not real. Just as you might have a magical show or an illusion, for example, the illusion of a magically created elephant, or the illusion of a magically created person, this illusion does not really originate. There isn't the real production of a person or an elephant. It only appears to originate, and it appears to cease. So in the same way, there is no real production of dharmas and no real destruction of dharmas. So this would be the line of explanation that you would find in the sutra literature. Now, this notion of non-origination or non-production is so important for the perfection of wisdom teaching, for the teaching of emptiness, for the teaching of the ultimate truth in the Mahayana tradition, that it has even given a name, one of the names by which the Madhyamaka school that was founded by Nagarjuna is known. The Madhyamaka school is known by several names. It's best known by the term I've just used, the Madhyamaka school, the middle way school, or the centrist school. But it's also called the Shunyavada school, the doctrine of emptiness. And it's also known as Ajativada, Ajativada, which means the doctrine of non-birth or non-production. Now, in the text of Nagarjuna, we have a lot of logical reasoning to establish the non-production or non-origination of entities. I am a little bit hesitant to get into that because we are going to cover it in the next term, in the next, in the second part of this course. The second part of this course is going to deal first and foremost with the Madhyamaka system and the expositions of Nagarjuna, and there you will see in great detail the logical, according to reason and systematic argumentation, the refutation of origination or production. I can just tell you that it goes something like this, that dharmas are not originated because if they existed, there would be no need for them to originate. And if they didn't exist, they couldn't originate because non-existent things can't come into existence. So there's and this is only the beginning. Originated things can't originate because they are already originated. Non-originated things can't originate because they are non-originated and therefore non-existent. So there is a whole raft of arguments of a logical and dialectical variety that are put forward in the Madhyamaka school by Nagarjuna and other Madhyamaka masters about the question of origination. But in the sutra literature, we find just examples, we find similes. So something seen in a dream, an object seen in a dream, is not really produced, and because it's not really produced, it isn't really existent, it doesn't really endure, and it isn't really destroyed. This is as far as the sutra literature goes, and we'll see in the Lankavatara also many different similes of illusion, illusory objects. A flower growing in the sky, a fairy city. All these things can't originate, can't be produced because they're not real, so they can't have any real production. Because they can't have any real production, they can't have any real duration, and they can't have any real extinction. So for this reason, the non-production of dharmas implies the non-applicability of all these other concepts that follow upon origination: duration, destruction, growth, decay, and so forth. So here we're dealing with a doctrine of no real origination, no real production. Those objects that appear to originate, that appear to be produced, are like the appearance or the origination of objects in a dream. They're not really originated. They only appear to originate. And since they only appear to originate, their duration and their destruction is also only apparent. It's only an illusion. So we're dealing with a doctrine basically of the illusory nature of dharmas, the illusory nature of phenomena. Okay? Is that, does that go some way toward answering your question? Yes.
When and how did Lisa become a female form in China?
Well, I mean, this is an interesting question, and I don't know that I have or that anybody has the final answer to that. The fact is, of course, that the enlightened beings are kind of asexual in the sense that they transcend sexuality. There's a very interesting passage in the Vimala Kirti Nirdesha where Sariputra is involved in a dialogue with a goddess, and Sariputra says to the goddess, well, since you, the goddess happens to be a bodhisattva, an enlightened being, Sariputra says to the goddess, well, why don't you change your form into the form of a man since you're enlightened? And the goddess says, well, why should I bother? Because enlightenment doesn't have a masculine form or a female form, so it doesn't matter whether I appear in the form in a female body or in a male body. And then further to demonstrate this, there's a sort of interchange, and Sariputra appears in a female body and the goddess appears in the body of Shariputra. And the whole point of it is that there's enlightenment really doesn't have any sex. So from that point of view, of course, there's nothing, there isn't any problem with Avalokiteshvara appearing in a female form. I can give you the anthropological, so-called, the anthropological answer, the answer that the religious anthropologists give to this question, and that is that they say that the figure of Avalokiteshvara with his qualities of compassion and mercy and so forth was fused in China with the goddess Matsu, the goddess of the sea, who also had similar qualities of being able to rescue people from trouble and having great mercy and compassion and so forth. And they these two figures fused in China, and so Avalokiteshvara assumed became female like Matsu. So that's the answer that the anthropologists... Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, it's hard to give a definitive answer. There are various, you know, theories about this. It's interesting. It's interesting because, of course, in Tibet, Avalokiteshvara is still male. Yes.
Can we say that because the image of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas will come in after the first century AD? And before that, before the use of image, it is only an oral tradition, or even a written tradition, but there was no image of what the Buddha looks like or should look like. And even today, the image is just representation. Tibetan Buddha will look Tibetan, Thai Buddha will look Thai, and the Chinese Buddha will look Chinese. But actually it's the same.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the image of the Buddha came in a little bit earlier than what you suggest. I mean, we begin to see images of the Buddha from about the 3rd century BC. But it's true that there were no images of the Buddha in the first couple of centuries, which is actually a very fascinating fact, and we wonder why that was the case. Of course, there's an account according to which the Buddha stopped, during the Buddha's lifetime, he stopped someone from making an image of the Buddha, of himself. And maybe this prohibition of the Buddha endured for a couple of hundred years. Maybe people in the early period, just after the life of the Buddha, hesitated to try to capture the Buddha in a statue, in an image, because the memory of the Buddha's greatness was so present, so real to them. So it's very difficult, but it is curious that for the first couple of hundred years, as you say, the Buddha was represented by symbols. It's represented by an empty seat, it's represented by the wheel, and other symbols, but we didn't have any images of the Buddha. Now, of course, when images come into play, the first images of the Buddha that were made in India looked Greek, because the craftsmen who came to India with Alexander during the invasion of the Greeks, the Greek invasion of India, they stayed behind and they were the first people to make images of the Buddha. So the first images of the Buddha have the Buddha looking like a Greek, not like an Indian or a Tibetan or a Chinese. So absolutely, as the joke goes in the Christian tradition, God made man in his image, and ever since man has been repaying the compliment. So of course the imagery of the Buddha and the Bodhisattvas will be culturally influenced, and it will depend on a number of factors, no doubt about that. It will depend also on the experience of meditators and how they happen to, according to their cultural conditioning and so forth, how they will perceive certain Buddhas. There's a story of how someone wanted to make an image of Maitreya, the future Buddha, and of course Maitreya is talked about in the Pali sources as the future Buddha. Someone wanted to make an image of Maitreya, and so they wanted to get it right, and someone had to go to the Tushita heaven to see Maitreya and come back and describe him to the artist so that he could get the image right. So of course images are just representations, and as representations they will partake of the biases and preferences of the representor, the person who makes the representation. Oh, countless, countless, incalculable. Take all these world systems, grind them into dust, and then that's how many Buddhas there are,
Is there any one Buddha? So why, as a scholar, what do you think about? Because modern time we're using this Mahayana Buddhism, this Theravada Buddhism, this is what they are. So Buddha's teaching only the one way. So why we use the different way of the Buddha's teaching?
Because people are different. Not everybody likes vanilla ice cream, Some people like strawberry ice cream. Some people like chocolate ice cream. People are different, They. I'm sorry. I don't mean to be. Don't mean to be facetious.
You mentioned that Mahayana is a great competition.
Yeah. No, nobody. please, nobody. Nobody is denying that Theravada talks a lot about compassion. If it didn't, we wouldn't have the missionary activity of the Theravada missionaries. From the very beginning. The Buddha, of course, told the first 60 disciples to go forth, not any of them to go by the same way, to go forth for the good of the many, for the benefit of the many, for the happiness of the many. So, of course the Theravada possesses compassion, and I was the first, I'm always the first person to say that the Theravada does teach compassion. We don't need Theravada is compassionate for the people whose inclinations are toward the Theravada. And Theravada is compassionate because it does care about the suffering of the people. The purpose of the Theravada, like the purpose of all the Buddhist traditions, is to alleviate suffering, to remove suffering. So obviously compassion is also at the heart of the Theravada teaching. The only difference is that the Mahayana says, stay the course, aspire to become a Buddha, because the Buddha has got more ability to benefit living beings than does an arhat who enters into nirvana after he achieves his liberation. Whereas a bodhisattva remains in the world for the benefit of living beings, and even after becoming a Buddha, he does not cease his activities. He continues to act for the benefit of living beings. So when we emphasize the motivation of compassion for the Mahayana, we're not saying that the Theravada doesn't possess compassion. We're just saying that this is one thing which the Mahayana places a great deal of emphasis upon. So I really don't want to, I always find myself, I mean, my karma, my problem, the reality of my life is that I always find myself in the middle. And when I say I find myself in the middle, what I mean is that when I'm together with academic people, they don't trust me because I'm a practitioner. And when I'm together with practitioners, a lot of times they don't trust me because I'm an academic. You know, when I talk to Theravada people, they are suspicious of me because I'm associated with the Mahayana. When I'm with Mahayana practitioners or Vajrayana practitioners, they wonder why I mix up with Theravada people and why I teach at Theravada centers and so forth. So I'm always in the middle. So if I come here to teach basic Mahayana doctrines, then the Theravada people here will say, what is he talking, you know, what he's trying to trying to undermine the Theravada or whatever. No, that's not true, because when I talk to Mahayana practitioners, I'm always praising the Theravada, because the Mahayana practitioners need to hear about, you know, the treasure that is the Theravada tradition. In fact, I just wrote I write a column for a Buddhist magazine in Singapore, and the theme for next month, for January, is the Theravada tradition. And I just wrote a column for the magazine, in which I say that all the best things that are in the Mahayana all come from the Theravada. So let's not, you know, neglect, and let's not overlook the foundations of our tradition, whether we're Mahayanists, whatever kind of Buddhists we are, we all owe a debt to the Theravada that we can never repay. That the Theravada is the foundation, it is the root of whatever blossoming, whatever growth took place in Buddhism. So, you know, I'm not anti-Theravada in any way.
Dr. Sandana,
yes.
Will it be fair to say, Theravada and the Mahayana and whatever is just a method of looking at it, a system by which the human being actually classify themselves. It has nothing to do with the Dhamma. And the Dhamma is taught by just the same man, the same thing. It's different views, different interpretation that brought about the scarcisms that appear today.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, this is what I have been trying to argue. Obviously, when I come to IBC with a brief to teach basic doctrines of the Mahayana, I have to concentrate on the basic doctrines of the Mahayana. But my personal view is that the Buddhist traditions are essentially one. That's why. And I think I referred to this briefly earlier in the week, I don't know how many of you caught it, but I said that this is why I named the book The Tree of Enlightenment, because the tree, for me, is an image of Buddhism. And it's an image of Buddhism where you have a root, a common root, and then you have a trunk, and then you have various branches and leaves and flowers and fruits, but they all have a common root, they all have a common source. And that common source is the teaching of the Buddha, and it's most clearly preserved in the Theravada tradition. Later you have a flowering, you have some elaboration, some expansion, according to the needs of human beings, according to the needs of living beings. What have we been talking about all these last few hours? The Siddharma Pundarika, the Lotus Sutra, expedient means, because people are different, because people have different necessities, because people are like children. Some children like Game Boys, some children like go-karts, some children like guns, you know? Children have different likings, and so if you want to bring them along, you have to pander to their likes and to their dislikes. And so the teaching of the Buddha appears, it relates to different people in different ways, because people are different, as I said to the person just a moment ago. The people are different, people have different tastes. And that's undeniable. You tell some person to go and sit and look at a wall for 6 years, he won't like it. So that one person may not like it. Another person may like it very much. You tell another person to go and do all the elaborate rituals and all the elaborate symbolic practices of the Vajrayana, he will go crazy. But another person will like that, will enjoy that, will find that as a good vehicle for him to express his religious aspiration. So Buddhism does manifest itself. It does relate to people in different ways according to their needs. There's a very beautiful simile in one of the Mahayana texts that uses the image of a wind chime. When you have a wind chime, it gives off different sounds according to the wind that is blowing. If a strong wind is blowing, it gives off one kind of sound. If a light breeze is blowing, it gives off another kind of sound. And the wind chime is like the teaching of the Buddha, or like the Buddha, like the enlightened principle or the enlightenment energy that I referred to before, at risk of sounding, you know, rather mystical. But this enlightenment energy, the teaching of the Buddha, it responds to the karmic needs of living beings. So, for example, I told the story of the Buddha taking Nanda to see the pink-footed nymphs. You know, that doesn't mean that Buddhism teaches that you should practice meditation so that you can get 500 pink-footed nymphs in your next life. It was just an expedient means to get Nanda over his attachment to his fiancée. So absolutely, the different manifestations in the different Buddhist traditions are responses to the different needs, to the different aptitudes, to the different even to different cultures, because a lot of what we say, you know, you look at Tibetan Buddhism, for example, and you say, my God, is this Buddhism? I mean, this is very different from Theravada Buddhism. But then when you go and you look at what the Tibetan tradition teaches, I first went to my Tibetan teacher, to the holy man who is still my guru after 35 years, I went to him to study Buddhism back in 1971, and what did he teach me? He taught me Nagarjuna Sudhalekha, and Nagarjuna Sudhalekha doesn't even mention emptiness once. Nagarjuna Sudhalekha is all about the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path. It's all about giving, morality, remembering the gods, honoring your parents, not telling lies, not sleeping with other people's wives. It's all about these basic Buddhist teachings. And that's what Tibetans learn. That's the first thing Tibetans learn. Don't think that Tibetans, as soon as they fall out of bed as little babies, they're given vajras and bells. No, they're taught basic Buddhism first. You know, so it's not so different. It looks different if you look at it from the outside. If you look at it from the inside, it's really not so different.
So at the end, there's only one vehicle.
Absolutely, that's what the Lotus Sutra says. Lotus Sutra says at the end there's only one vehicle. In the middle, there are different vehicles. Actually, you know, it would be true to say that at the beginning there's only one vehicle, and at the end there's only one vehicle. It's in the middle that there are different vehicles. In the beginning, there's only one vehicle because Buddhism starts, all the Buddhist schools start at exactly the same place, suffering. How to get rid of suffering, the problem of suffering. That is the starting point, whether you're Mahayana, Vajrayana, Theravada, Chan, Zen, whatever you may be, Pure Land, you start with suffering. That is the starting point. And you end with enlightenment. That is the end point. In between, you take different roads.
So in Theravada, we say the human world, this human world is best suitable for enlightenment. Samma Sambuddha to arrive.
Yes.
So is there any other Samma Sambuddha in the another world? Or?
Well, I mean, in the according to the Mahayana, there are many, many worlds. And there are Buddhas in these various world systems, but as far as I mean, you're referring to the human world, to the human condition, and certainly the Mahayana agrees with that. The Mahayana says that the human condition is the best condition for practicing the Dharma and for achieving liberation and enlightenment. We have exactly the same story. In the Tibetan tradition, the one that you have in the Pali tradition, the one about the tortoise at the bottom of the ocean that comes to the surface every 100 years, the blind tortoise, and is supposed to put his neck through a yoke that is floating on the surface of the ocean, and that is an example for how difficult it is to achieve human birth. And then there is a discussion about the 18 favorable conditions, the 8 freedoms and the 10 positive conditions for practicing the Dharma. We have exactly the same thing in the Tibetan tradition. So Mahayana and Vajrayana, we all agree on the fact that human birth is the most conducive condition for the practice of the Dharma and the attainment of enlightenment. We defend Buddhism because we say, look, Buddhism is the most liberal of all of the world religions. The Buddhism enables everyone to find for themselves the practice that is most suitable for them. And so far, at least, even though we may disagree, we haven't had any wars between the various Buddhist traditions, and which is not the same, that cannot be said of Christianity or Islam, where Sunnis and Shias are fighting each other today, where Protestants and Catholics are still fighting each other, even today in the 21st century. At least in Buddhism, we haven't had those kind of problems. We might disagree, we might call each other bad names, but we don't actually fight each other. So look here, we have Buddhism, we have an ancient teaching which manifests itself in many different ways. You can come here, this is a very large assortment of practices, of traditions, see which one suits you. If you like, you can even make up your own form of Buddhism. You can take a little bit from here, a little bit from there, which, believe me, is what is happening in the West. People are taking Buddhism, elements of Theravada Buddhism. There are people in America who are practitioners of Vipassana and also practitioners of Vajrayana. You know, I myself do breathing meditation, walking meditation along side my Vajrayana sadhanas. I don't see any problem with that. And so when we defend Buddhism, if we really speaking, we don't need to defend Buddhism. I mean, Buddhism is but if we're challenged, if people want to know why Buddhism is a valid option, we say, well, it's, you know, it is the only world religion that has for one of its principal tenets nonviolence. It's the only world religion where you have the founder of the religion that actually went and stopped the war instead of promoting one. You know, so Buddhism has got all of these treasures, and besides, it's got choice. I mean, it's got a whole assortment of practices and traditions that you can follow. You can do anything from, you know, practice Vajrayana to chant in the Pure Land system. You can practice Zen. You can practice Theravada. You can practice Mahayana. You have an immense choice. And with that choice, that choice doesn't mean that you have to necessarily, that you're going to become embroiled in conflict with the other Buddhist traditions. So in that sense, you know, I think, and really, this is, again, the problems present themselves again and again. When I first went to Singapore back in 1982, my first job my job there was to coordinate the school program for Buddhist studies for the secondary schools. But in actual fact, the first thing that we had to do was to make Buddhism credible, because people in Singapore, particularly young people in Singapore, they all thought that Buddhism is some sort of old-fashioned, superstitious mumbo jumbo, that, you know, it was okay for their grandparents, but now they were all modern and educated and westernized, and so they would either be free thinkers or they would be Christians. And the first thing we had to do was make Buddhism respectable again, respectable in the eyes of young, educated people. And, you know, thank goodness, by the power of the Buddha, we managed to do that, in the sense that many, many people at that time learned about Buddhism. And now when you go to Singapore, the centers are full of young people. They're full of 20, 30, 35, 40-year-olds. They're full of young people, English-educated young people. And the image of Buddhism has changed. And it is changing everywhere. But in all the traditionally Buddhist countries, there is to some extent this problem. This problem exists in Thailand. It exists to some extent, I would imagine, in Sri Lanka, in Bangladesh. There's this sort of idea, because the West is the most militarily and economically powerful entity on the face of the earth, so there's a sort of, there's a kind of association that, well, the religion of the West, i.e., therefore Christianity, that this must be the best religion, because since the West has become so powerful and so dominant, so its religion must be the best religion. And other religions must in some way kind of measure up to Christianity or compete with Christianity. Well, I've got some news for all of you. First of all, in the West, people are running away from Christianity in the millions. I mean, nobody goes to church. Hardly anybody goes to church anymore in Europe. If you go to Italy, where I live, for example, you go to church, you see only old ladies and a few old men. Nobody's going to church anymore. In England, in the UK, the churches are empty. They don't know what to do with them. They're turning them into concert halls. They're turning them into... People are running away from Christianity. People no longer believe in Christianity. Where does Christianity still persist? In Africa. It's growing in Africa. It still persists in Latin America. But in America and in Europe, it's on the decline. And also, I can tell you that if I'm looking at Christianity, and this is, I'm not saying this because I happen to be a Buddhist, but as a student of religion and philosophy and someone who's been in this field, Christianity is really a very primitive religion. It really has nothing to do. It's a complete accident. I mean, the West did not become powerful because of Christianity. The West became powerful because of industrialization. The West became powerful because of military technology. That's why the West became powerful. It didn't become powerful because of Christianity. It had nothing to do with Christianity. You know, so we should stop. We should stop being embarrassed or feeling that we have to defend Buddhism. Buddhism is one is probably the greatest tradition, you know, ever to bless humankind. It's made maybe some of the greatest contributions to world heritage. And so we really should not. We should start to be proud of Buddhism. We shouldn't think that if we're Buddhists, we're not being modern or we're not being Western. That's one of the big one of the contributions that I can make, because simply because I'm in a Western body and I happen to be a Buddhist, it sends a signal, right? It sends a signal to people who are born in Buddhist countries that Buddhism is not just a culturally specific, or it's not just something that exists in Asia and former countries that were formerly colonized by Christian powers and so forth, but it is something that exists, you know, that is appreciated. And that's really the point that I wanted to get to, that in Asia you find a lot of people thinking Buddhism is sort of backward and this and that, but in the West there's a completely different attitude toward Buddhism. In the West, the intellectual elite, the educated classes in the West, have a very, very positive view of Buddhism. Even if they aren't practicing Buddhists, they have a very, very positive view of Buddhism. They believe Buddhism is very profound. They believe Buddhism is a very humane religion. They believe Buddhism is a very tolerant religion. They believe Buddhism is a very intellectually open religion. And they appreciate that in Buddhism. Einstein said, he himself expressed his preference for Buddhism. He said that, "I am not a religious person, but if I were, I would be a Buddhist, that Buddhism is the best religion that I have been able to see." And Einstein's not the only one. There are, you know, many, many, not only Hollywood actors, but many, 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 many intelligent people, astrophysicists, psychologists, civil servants, judges, important people who are either explicitly Buddhist or who are sympathizers, who sympathize with Buddhism, who have a great respect for Buddhism. So let's put this into perspective. I mean, that's why 25 years ago, the first chapter in the Tree of Enlightenment is called Buddhism in a Modern Perspective. And I'm trying there to put the record straight and to say to people in Southeast Asia, look, the problem is you're too close to Buddhism, you don't appreciate it. You know? Because Buddhism is something you grew up with, you take it for granted, you look for faults in it. Actually, if you look at Buddhism from the point of view of a Westerner, you appreciate it more. Because you can see all the advantages, all the merits that Buddhism has over religions like Christianity and so forth. So, you know, it's time for us to, as Buddhists, all of us, whether we're from Bangladesh or from Thailand or from China or from Singapore or Malaysia, wherever we may be from, it's time for us to say, you know, we are the heirs. We have inherited probably the greatest religious treasure, the greatest world, the greatest treasure of wisdom that the world has ever been blessed with. Let's develop it. Let's take pride in it. Let's be comfortable with it. Let's not feel that we have to apologize for it or defend it or be ashamed of it in any way. On the contrary, this is, you know, a great treasure with which we've been blessed.
I think no more question now. You've started.